CBSI in the world. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Frank Frankopan, Peter Frankopan, Oxford and Worcester College Professor of Global History. We're now in the Roman Warm period, which is a delight because I've done so much of my reading most recently about all of the Game of Thrones played around Rome and throughout the Mediterranean world, and now to discover it again as reacting to and dealing with and getting lucky about climate is a joy. Peter, you've already mentioned Cleopatra, who steals the scenes, but the Romans have an important philosophical approach to ecology, to nature. They want to live in harmony with it. At the same time, they want to take advantage of it to spread their empire. The Romans, from the what you present, Peter, look to be lucky. Is that too much to take away from their achievements? They were at the right place at the right time, in the right part of the world, with the Mediterranean as their road to build empire. And yet, at the same time, the climate was not disruptive. At least it wasn't disorderly as it could have been in other periods.
I think you could widen that, John. If we had a long time with a glass of wine, you know, I'd maybe say that all empires need to be lucky. All empires need to get institutions right. They need to get justice systems right, and they need to get forms of equality right to be stable, because otherwise they topple over. So Rome did lots of things that were to do with skill of good administration and good institutions, but all empires are extractive. You know, their aim is to widen the peripheries and to not just go and colonize and conquer space for the sake of it, but to conquer space that is ecologically important, either because it is good for fields and crops or trees, or because it has minerals or whatever that might be, stone. Or in the modern era, the race for oil, the race for lithium today. So there are always extractive powers that are driving the expansion of empire. But where Rome was lucky was that between the eruption of Okmok in 43, for the next 250 years, almost 300 years, it's a time of real stability environmentally. What that means is that a bit like your household budget, if your paycheck comes in every month and you know what you're going to expect, you can plan for the future. You can take a few risks now and again. What derails you is if suddenly you lose your job and your mortgage payments fall due and you can't make ends meet. And so for the 250 years after Octavius, or then Augustus, becomes emperor and Rome takes on this magnificence, where Augustus, when he dies, he says, I found this city of Rome built in marble and I found the city built in brick and I left it in marble. Rome's transformation is huge. But for the next 300 years, they don't have big shocks. There's a plague outbreak in the second century, but otherwise it's business as usual. And that allows for you to plan, occasionally take risks, fund your army, and have reliable and understandable levels of economic inflationary controls. That all goes wrong in the 230s. Over the course of the next 30, 40 years, instead of having one emperor passing on to the next and murders behind the couch every now and again, you find 26 emperors in the course of about 40 years, with about double that number of would-be emperors. And that's not just because Roman society has become more tendentious, more argumentative. It's because there's a series of crises, and crises give opportunities for people to chance their arm. So once the bubble pops, the question is, how do you rebalance? And eventually Rome rebalances by the great emperor Constantine dominating all the other competitors for the throne, and eventually building a new city, which he calls New Rome, on the banks of the Bosphorus, in what's now, which the city became called after him, Constantinople, now known as Istanbul. But I think the moral of the story of Rome is that if you can avoid shocks and you stay lucky, then you can be the master of your own destiny. You can still get plenty of things wrong. You can still cut down all the trees. You can still run out of food. You can still be stabbed in the bath. But if you keep experiencing shock, then it's very, very hard to be able to respond.
Yes, you quote wonderfully Shakespeare. When sorrows come, they come not in single spies, but in battalions. So let's listen to the battalions that come to Rome and that they survive. You've mentioned the 3rd century AD, but there's a subplot which we passed by, but I want to go back to it. The aridity of Central Asia, the grassland spreading from the east to the west, and here comes the horse. And I believe the horse will be part of the magic of the Huns that eventually plunder Rome in the early 5th century. creating Constantinople as a power. The horse, in your telling, Peter, the horse is a magical character. Was the horse treated that way when it reached Europe and when it reached North America? Always magical.
Magical. I mean, in fact, where the horse is really magical is in both India and in China. So in the Vedic text, the horse plays a totally sacred role. And in China, horses, individual horses have, they have names that are more famous than the multi-time winner of the Kentucky Derby or the Grand National here. So the horse is held in huge respect because, of course, it allows humans to cover long distances at great speed. Horses play a great role in dragging chariots, so they can increase your military capabilities, as well as your ability to spread information, potentially reliably, not always, but to spread information quickly. So the horse is key. And of course, then the next question is that some of those regions in central China, in India as a whole, in the Middle East, are not very good lands to rear horses because you need a lot of water and pasture. And the great expertise of the Central Asian or the nomads living across the Eurasian steppes is to breed very, very large herds of horses and to train them. So these horses are in huge demand and huge demand across all societies. When they're first introduced into Mesopotamia, the accounts describe sheer terror at being able to handle an animal this magnificent and strong-willed. But once horsepower becomes harnessed by humans, it becomes a source that, one could argue, allows for the conquest of the Americas by Europeans, because the one big difference between the Americas and Europe, Africa, and Asia is the absence of large pack animals in the Americas before the European arrivals. So I think that the horse is hugely important to try to think about. And those Huns you mentioned, John, as a result of changing circumstances on the climate and pressures of food and pasture, it creates a series of interconnected events that force tribes to cooperate with each other that then become competitive forces. And in the case of the Huns, they spill over into Europe and very easily dismantle the infrastructure of the Roman Empire, probably not through force and violence, but just because once connections break down between cities and the center, it's very hard to rebuild them. Once bureaucrats have left their jobs, no one knows how to do anything. So I guess, again, like in Iraq, after the Ba'ath Party were taken out of power in 2003, if you lose all your bureaucrats in one fell swoop, no one knows how to charge taxes. No one knows where to put the money. No one knows how to make the state work. And things collapse very quickly.
There's another subplot in Peter's telling, which is large cities, large empires are strong because of trade. They have their strengths. They have their ability to specialize. But they're brittle as well when there's a major change in climate, especially drought. I noted again and again, Peter, city-states that are set up, built with elaborate aqueducts or ability to gain water to irrigate their crops, when a drought of not very substance, 3 or 4 years is a drought that we experience often in the U.S., the governance cannot hold the empire together.
I mean, it's terrifying, but I mean, I think that's right. I mean, for example, the city of Dubai at the moment in the Middle East carries 24 hours water reserves. That's it. So you can see how a single event or catastrophic failure of water systems for whatever reason suddenly makes a city unviable overnight. In the 20th century, Russia or Soviet Union twice collapsed in a matter of days. This huge, huge empires can suddenly fold very, very quickly. And I think that's something that's quite salutary to realize that it's a bit like a house of cards that can be very tall, but you take one out, the whole thing comes tumbling down. So I think in the ancient world, we see time and again patchworks of cities that cross rely, they compete with each other, they all look impregnable, and yet they fail because trade networks go down, and the things that follow often come to food shortages, inflation and violence, war and escalation, but also lower calorie consumption. And that affects immune systems. That means you're more immunocompromised to pathogens. And then when diseases catch hold, you're into a doom spiral, and suddenly cities that were once great disappear. And the greatest cities of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, if we'd been alive then, John, and were able to do this by Zoom, we'd have been talking in and about Uruk, or Nineveh, or Nippur, or Angkor 1,000 years ago, or Isfahan or Bukhara, cities that people may have heard of, but few can put a place on the map, whereas most people know where New York City is, or London, and so on. So I think that those compressions of how collapses can happen when a single plank is pulled out are quite interesting in the past to see those fragilities.
And again, I want to emphasize here, my reading of your presentation, Peter, is that climate doesn't drive change. It is part of change. It augments change. It is something to respond to. And your resilience is the measure of how you hold yourself together for the next epoch. Do I say all that correctly? You want to adjust
that? Yes. No, I think that's right. And I mean, we remember that from biblical texts and the Abrahamic faiths, you know, that the world was created as a perfect paradise by God. And at the last minute, the humans were put there with the simple instruction, don't eat from the forbidden tree. And otherwise, you'll have everything you need, the right amount of rain, neither too much nor too little, a Goldilocks zone. And what happened by disobeying God is that the punishment was through ecological means. So the being expelled from the Garden of Eden meant that Adam and Eve had to scrabble around in the dirt to try to make crops grow. They had to be grateful for when rains came. They had to try to control an environment that was hostile. And in fact, repeatedly after that, the flood of Noah or the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, done by a vengeful God who was angered by the way in which humans lived unsustainably and unkindly. So those stories about how we should learn about the past and be sensitive to the pressures, I think that is exactly right. That the ability to try to harness the environment and to use it sustainably is something that has such a long pedigree and a long history that it's not just something to do with us here in the 21st century.
The book is The Earth Transformed, An Untold History. Peter Frankopan is the author. We're headed to another warm period called the Medieval Warm Period, approximately in the common era, 900 to 1250. And the discovery of something called North America by Scandinavian voyagers. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.